What if the market is fundamentally mispricing one of the most visible companies on Earth simply because standard valuation models literally cannot compute a lack of risk?
It is a profound contradiction. I mean, we're so conditioned to markets demanding a premium for certainty.
Right. Imagine an asset with cash flows less uncertain than a U.S. Treasury bond, yet structurally penalized by the mechanical limitations of a spreadsheet.
Exactly. When an entity achieves a scale of permanence that defies traditional risk parameters, well, the standard mathematical tools we rely on to price assets begin to fail completely.
Welcome to this deep dive video, Visual, Clean, Classic Title Card, The Visa Reef, Structural Valuation and Moat Analysis. Today, we are unpacking a highly compelling piece of institutional research titled The Visa Reef. Our objective for the sophisticated investor here is to deconstruct the mechanics of the world's strongest investment moat.
Yes, and to rigorously analyze the structural realities of global commerce digitalization.
Precisely. And ultimately, we will examine the valuation concept known as the gratuity premium. So let's establish our foundation with section one, the architecture.
To really grasp the valuation anomaly we're building toward, we have to start with the mechanical foundation of the business itself. The analysis introduces this
being premature, correct.
Exactly. It's constructed on regulatory mandates, patents, or paper contracts. And the problem with a moat built on paper is that another piece of paper can dissolve it.
Right.
But a coral moat is anti-fragile. It is built by sheer, relentless usage over decades. That distinction is absolutely critical for institutional capital allocation.
And to understand it, we really have to discard the most common misconception about Visa. People view it as a financial institution.
Which it is not.
No, it isn't. Visa doesn't run money. Visa doesn't hold deposits. It assumes absolutely zero credit risk.
Zero. It doesn't carry physical inventory, and it doesn't construct factories. Visa provides a single, unyielding utility.
It operates a network through which a buyer and a seller trust each other enough to execute a transaction. Think about the last time you tapped your card for a coffee in a foreign country. You didn't know the merchant, they didn't know you.
And neither of you knew the exact daily exchange rate.
Exactly. But within 800 milliseconds, the transaction cleared seamlessly. That 800 milliseconds of comprehensive, absolute trust, that is the actual product.
It is. The physical plastic card, the EMV chip, the digital wallet on your smartphone, those are just the temporal vehicles of the decade.
The vehicles inevitably evolve.
Right, but the underlying trust layer doesn't. And the scale of this architecture becomes, well, staggering when you isolate the figures. We are looking at 4 billion cards in circulation globally.
4 billion.
130 million merchants. And over $17 trillion in annual payment volume.
Which brings up an interesting paradox and leads us directly into section two, the wave that has barely begun. When you are processing $17 trillion, the immediate question for any growth-oriented analyst is, where is the ceiling?
Right. How does an entity already operating at this staggering magnitude actually find room to expand without deploying massive capital expenditure?
Visual. Subtle data visualization mapping global cash usage against digital infrastructure.
Exactly.
The answer lies in a rather surprising macroeconomic reality. Despite the ubiquity of digital payments in jurisdictions like North America or Western Europe, 85% of global transactions are still conducted in physical cash.
Wait, really? 85% feels extraordinarily high. Isn't that dynamic primarily isolated to emerging markets?
It is heavily concentrated there, certainly, but it is a global average. Across India, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, the overwhelming majority of daily commerce remains anchored to physical currency.
Fascinating.
Therefore, the addressable market for Visa is not the $17 trillion it currently processes. The addressable market is the entirety of the global economy. Let's dissect the financial mechanics of capturing that remaining market, specifically the dynamic the text defines between the toll and the growth. Usually, in standard enterprise valuation, these two concepts are at war.
They compete fiercely for capital, yes.
Right. The toll is the mechanism generating today's revenue. But to get growth, you need capital. If a technology conglomerate wants to capture new volume, they have to build new data centers or aggressively acquire competitors.
The toll and the growth fiercely compete for the exact same shareholder dollar.
Exactly.
But for Visa, the growth is functionally free. Visa does not finance the digitalization of global commerce.
It doesn't manufacture the smartphones that enable mobile wallets.
Precisely. It doesn't lay the fiber optic cables, deploy the point-of-sale terminals, or engineer the e-commerce platforms.
Telecommunications firms, commercial banks, governments, and independent tech entrepreneurs are funding and constructing all of that infrastructure.
Yes. Once it is built, Visa simply collects a fractional toll automatically as the transactions flow over it. Because this growth requires zero capital from Visa, the toll and the growth don't compete, they multiply.
So, telecommunication giants and banks are essentially doing the heavy lifting, laying the concrete for the highway.
And Visa just sets up the toll booth.
That allows for an exceptional capital allocation profile. Visa can sustain double-digit revenue growth while simultaneously returning massive amounts of free cash flow to shareholders via buybacks.
The analysis aptly applies the second law of thermodynamics to this phenomenon. The complexity of payment systems only moves in one direction. Cash does not replace cards.
Cards do not replace digital wallets.
Exactly. The migration toward digital intermediation is an irreversible one-way street. Every technological step forward inevitably deposits more volume onto Visa's network, thickening the coral reef.
Well, let me push back on this invincibility narrative as we move into section three. The three headwinds. No investment thesis exists in a vacuum. If this growth is mathematically inevitable and structurally free, we have to confront the existential threats dominating the financial headlines.
Certainly. Rigorous analysis requires it.
Let's start with regulatory pressure. Specifically, initiatives like the Credit Card Competition Act in the U.S. and proposed settlements capping consumer credit card interchange at, say, 1.25%. Visual. Clean structural diagram differentiating interchange flow to banks versus network assessment fees to Visa. Surely government-mandated price compression threatens the fundamental model.
It is a highly common misinterpretation of the revenue model, one that often creates noise in the market. You have to separate interchange fees from network assessments.
Interchange fees do not flow to Visa, correct?
Correct. They flow to the issuing banks to compensate for credit risk and to fund those lucrative consumer rewards programs. Visa's revenue is derived from assessment fees, a fraction of a cent charged on the sheer volume of transactions processed, regardless of what the interchange rate is.
But wait, when the Durbin Amendment passed in 2011, it heavily capped debit card interchange fees in the United States. The banks took a massive hit. How did a cap on transaction fees translate to a win for the network processing those transactions?
I understand the math on that feels counterintuitive.
It does.
But it operates exactly like the highway tool we discussed. The regulatory action successfully compressed the economic margins for the issuing banks, yes. However, for Visa, it simply lowered the cost of the toll per vehicle on the highway.
And what happens when you lower a toll?
Sure.
Traffic increases.
Exactly. Visa's assessment revenue actually grew because the total volume of transactions grew. The regulation attacks the bank's margin. It doesn't attack the network's volume.
Fascinating. So the regulation essentially forces a price cut on the merchant's end, which encourages more merchants to accept the card, which drives up Visa's volume.
Precisely.
Let's move to headwind number two, stablecoins. Transfer volume hit $33 trillion in 2025. The underlying proposition here is undeniably compelling: the ability to settle transactions on a blockchain at fractions of a cent, theoretically bypassing the traditional 2-3% card rails entirely.
The technological achievement of stablecoins is significant, but we must rigorously differentiate between a settlement rail and a trust layer. Stablecoins provide a highly efficient capital-light rail. However, a rail is not a consumer product.
The product, as we established earlier with the coffee transaction, is trust.
Exactly. Visa provides sophisticated fraud protection, chargeback mechanisms, and dispute resolution.
Right. Let me use an analogy here to see if I'm tracking this. Stablecoins are essentially like fiber optic cables. They move data instantly and cheaply. But Visa is the SSL certificate and the password protection that makes you actually trust putting your credit card into the browser in the first place. If you transact directly in a stablecoin like USDC and suffer fraud, the money is gone. You possess zero recourse.
Correct.
But if you transact with Visa, you have a 60-day window to contest it.
That is a perfect framework. The fiber optic cable doesn't replace the security protocol, it just makes it run faster.
Mm.
Furthermore, the analysis points out that Visa isn't rigidly defending against stablecoins, it's actively absorbing them into its architecture.
Ah, I see.
Currently, $4.5 billion in annualized stablecoin settlement flows directly through VisaNet.
So they aren't fighting the current, they're just rerouting it through their own toll booth.
Precisely. Visa is positioning its architecture as the indispensable bridge, the institutional on-ramp and off-ramp between the blockchain rail and real-world commerce. If stablecoins achieve global ubiquity, Visa merely becomes the trust layer operating on top of that new rail.
Which brings us to the third headwind, which might be the most structurally threatening. Sovereign rails. Visual. Elegant, split-screen contrasting sovereign domestic networks with transnational network flows. We are observing government-engineered payment systems, UPI in India, PIX in Brazil, SEPA Instant in Europe.
Yes, explicit state-sponsored attempts to bypass international card networks for domestic transactions.
And to be intellectually honest with our analysis, Visa has indeed lost domestic market share in jurisdictions like India.
They are formidable systems, without question. However, their fundamental limitation is embedded in the definition itself. They are strictly domestic.
Because the modern economy is inherently transnational.
Exactly. A corporation managing cross-border supply chains, or a consumer traveling from London to Tokyo, requires a seamlessly integrated global network. Sovereign rails cannot provide that interconnectivity.
And there's a credit underwriting component they lack as well, right?
Yes. Moreover, these are entirely debit-based direct account transfer systems. They do not possess the global risk assessment, underwriting logic, or distribution infrastructure required to facilitate credit.
Synthesizing this section, it becomes clear that each headwind is attacking an isolated layer. Regulation attacks the pricing of the toll. Stablecoins attempt to disrupt the underlying rail.
And sovereign systems attack specific domestic volume.
Exactly. Yet none of these threats comprehensively attack the global trust layer.
Correct. Over 7 decades, Visa has navigated the transition from the magnetic stripe to the EMV chip, to contactless NFC, to mobile tokens. Businesses die from technological disruption only when their moat is the technology itself.
And Visa's moat isn't the plastic card, it's trusted intermediation.
Precisely.
Which leads us directly into section 4, the gratuity premium and negative risk premium. Let's connect these structural realities back to the bold premise we opened the video with.
The core financial anomaly of this entire analysis.
Right. The market sees Visa with perfect clarity. The margins, the take rates, the transaction volumes, these are highly public metrics. Yet the text argues it remains structurally undervalued, not due to market irrationality, but because our standard financial modeling is fundamentally broken when it encounters this level of permanence.
To understand this mispricing, we have to examine the mechanics of a discounted cash flow model, or DCF visual. A strictly minimal mathematical formula fading in, isolating the denominator of a DCF model, specifically highlighting the discount rate. Standard valuation models discount a company's future cash flows back to their present value using a discount rate.
And that rate is comprised of a risk-free rate, typically the yield on a 10-year U.S. Treasury bond, plus an equity risk premium.
Yes, analysts generally apply a premium of 3% to 5% on top of the risk-free rate.
So just to ensure absolute clarity on the mechanics, you mathematically penalize the valuation of those future cash flows to compensate the investor for uncertainty. You are pricing in the risk that the business might fail, a competitor might erode the moat, or the growth might unexpectedly stall out.
Exactly. But the analysis posits a radical thought experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Visa's future cash flows rely simply on humanity continuing to engage in commerce and the ongoing one-way digitalization of those transactions.
Yeah.
Those cash flows are arguably less uncertain than the solvency of a sovereign government. The probability that human beings cease buying goods and services is intrinsically lower than the probability of a sovereign debt default.
I understand the philosophy, but mathematically, how does that break the model?
It forces us to ask a rather difficult question of the formula. If the inherent risk of the asset is genuinely lower than the so-called risk-free rate, the equity risk premium should theoretically be negative.
A negative risk premium.
Yes. And this is where the spreadsheet mechanics completely fail. A standard cell in a financial model cannot accept a negative risk premium. Let's look at the mathematics. If you assume a standard 5% discount rate on Visa's $19 per share of free cash flow, you arrive at an approximate valuation of $380.
Okay, so 5% gives you $380. But if we accept the premise of a structurally negative risk premium, meaning the cash flows are so certain they demand a lower discount, and we apply, for example, a 3% discount rate, what happens to the valuation?
The present value of those exact same cash flows aggressively re-rates to approximately $640.
$640, and the current market price sits near $300. That is a staggering disparity.
That massive mathematical gap is what the text defines as the gratuity premium. It is the portion of intrinsic value that remains permanently invisible to the market price because our mathematical models literally cannot compute a negative risk premium.
The model breaks at exactly the point where the fundamental truth of the business begins.
Precisely.
This implies a gratuity premium isn't just a temporary market dislocation or a momentary dip. It exists persistently. Whether the price-to-earnings multiple sits at 22, 28, or 35, the invisible defense, 7 decades of institutional trust, 130 million merchant relationships, sophisticated global fraud infrastructure, is never fully priced in.
The market easily prices the visible loud threats like stablecoin volume, but it assigns zero value to the silent, self-reinforcing reef.
It highlights a profound structural blind spot in modern equity valuation. The market overvalues what it can easily quantify within a standard risk model, and it systematically undervalues what requires a fundamental reevaluation of risk itself.
Exactly.
Which brings us to our final core concept, Section 5, double naturality and the future. As we look toward the future and bring this analysis to its ultimate conclusion regarding long-term institutional wealth generation, we do need to be realistic.
A rigorous analysis requires acknowledging that trees don't grow to the sky.
Right. It is highly probable that Visa's take rates will face slow compression over the next decade, perhaps moving from 0.20% down to 0.15% as the sheer volume scales. Cross-border premiums will likely narrow as stablecoins and blockchain rails capture specific institutional B2B flows.
We should absolutely assume those headwinds will moderate overall growth. Instead of the historic 15% growth rates we've seen, we may be looking at a moderated 10 to 12% annually going forward.
But let's contextualize that moderation. We're talking about 10 to 12% compounding annual growth, operating on 50% net margins, requiring near zero capital expenditure.
All propelled by a macro wave where 85% of the world is still transacting in physical cash.
It remains an unparalleled economic engine.
It does. The text introduces a final framework it calls double naturality to describe this incredibly rare architecture. First, the moat is natural and free. The users themselves maintain the network's dominance simply by transacting.
And second?
Second, the growth is natural and free. The broader digitalization of the global economy pushes volume onto the network, without Visa requiring internal capital expenditure to capture it.
Contrast that double naturality with traditional technology moats. Think about a semiconductor manufacturer or a massive consumer hardware company. They have to aggressively reinvest billions of dollars in CapEx every cycle just to maintain their competitive position.
They basically have to rebuild their moat from scratch every 5 years.
Exactly. But Visa's trust moat requires no rebuilding.
Precisely. A regulatory moat is fragile. A technological moat requires constant expensive reconstruction. But a network usage moat is anti-fragile. It strengthens silently with every passing transaction.
The visible headwinds we discussed, regulation, sovereign rails, crypto rails, they're real, but their impact is temporary, and crucially, they are already fully priced into the equity.
The reef, however, is permanent, and its ongoing expansion is entirely free.
As we conclude this deep dive, the ultimate takeaway for the sophisticated investor is clear. Our financial frameworks are hyper-optimized to price visible risk and visible disruption. They are remarkably poorly equipped to price inevitable capital-light permanence.
The coral grows in silence while the ocean does the heavy lifting. The toll collects automatically, and the digital wave has, in truth, barely begun.
Which leaves us with a final, unaddressed philosophical question for you to consider regarding your own portfolio models. If a corporate trust network genuinely possesses a lower probability of default than a sovereign nation's debt, is it time for institutional finance to completely redefine what we use as the risk-free rate in modern portfolio theory?
That is the pivotal question.
To explore these investment strategies further and discover more from the collection, visit the website averagingup.com. Visual. Fade to a clean institutional end screen with the URL averagingup.com gracefully displayed in a serif font.